Good evening, this is Gary Kavanagh here on the right side with my friend and colleague Michael Dwyer. Today we have a couple of things we want to go through. We want to talk about divestment in schools and how it isn't working out quite how it was expected to. We want to talk about a housing development in Coolock and how it shows why there will be no houses built in Dublin and we will all live and die on the streets. But before we go on to that, Michael, I have a very important question for you.
What's this?
And it's this. Do you think it's right that people who are willing to spend money should be able to get faster healthcare than those who don't?
Is it right?
You mean,
is it moral?
Should we as a society allow people who spend money on healthcare get better or quicker healthcare than those who don't?
Well, I don't think it's a moral issue. Yes, is it? The short answer, because otherwise we would have to stop people doing something, and I don't think we should be in the business of doing that. The state certainly shouldn't be in the business of doing something.
You might not realize this, Michael, but there has been a debate in, should we say, medical academic circles in Ireland in the last while about inequalities of access in this country and how outrageous they are, which is to say, the fact that you with private healthcare can get healthcare quicker than someone who doesn't have private healthcare has been seen as a problem and something that has to be stopped.
Yeah, but this has been seen as a problem for years. Exactly the same discussion happens around the subject of education. And it always goes back to, ultimately, it's a fine distinction, but an important one, certainly in the healthcare. They decide that ultimately it'll have to be okay for very rich people to get better health care. But for people who say just upper middle class professionals, well, then they shouldn't. Why do I mean that? I mean, what they're ultimately seem to be saying is that if possible, they're not all of them, but I've met a number of who would basically like to see the end of private health care in the country. No more health. However, if you're sufficiently rich to be able to get on a plane and go to the Mayo Clinic, or go to the famous cancer centre? God, my brain. You know the one I mean. In the clinics in New York or in Baltimore, then fine, go ahead, because we can't stop people flying. But by God, we can stop people here who can't afford to do that kind of, we can stop them getting better healthcare.
So the reason I'm asking you this question is the country has been talking about this for a while, but now it looks like something might actually happen.
Yeah.
Because now there's a new report by Donald de Boutelaire, who was involved in the creation of the HSE. He's been very involved in various parts of the state, actually. I've met him before, he's a good guy. But here's the thing, his report recommends that private healthcare should be totally stripped out of public healthcare.
Right.
Now, for those who don't know, what currently happens in a lot of the Irish healthcare system is you have private and public patients in public facilities, and consultants are able to treat private patients in public facilities basically off the clock. So if you're a consultant in a hospital and you're off at 5, you can see a private patient in a facility in the hospital at 6. As long as you set it up and you pay for it and all of that sort of thing. Which means that private patients can use public facilities much faster than public patients can, as long as they're willing to pay the costs incurred by that the HSE simply wouldn't pay themselves anyway. And the de Boutelaire report, which has just come out, and is mostly related to Sláintecare, says that should be stopped. The problem there is this. Private patients pay for all of that.
Yeah.
To the tune of about 650 million a year. Or if you prefer, I think that's over 10% of all acute hospitals' budget.
Right.
And they do it in times, they do it at times that it doesn't impact on the public sector because it's done off the clock, as it were.
Yeah, but they're taking a bed up. And we have a shortage of beds, do we not?
We do. Well, actually, that depends what you mean, Michael, because there are enough physical beds. The problem is paying for the staff for those beds.
Yeah.
So even on that basis, private patients tend to pay for a lot.
Also, the bed shortage is not evenly distributed. There seem to be some hospitals, it's very acute. In other hospitals, it's not really a problem at all. So there may possibly be a management issue in the allocation of beds there. But what's the practical advantage of doing this? I'm not interested in some kind of notional, social, or moral advantage. There must be a practical. This discussion about the fact that, say, you have consultants having private clinics and private consulting rooms and seeing private patients in public hospitals has been going on for a long time. And there is a reasonable reaction, I think, for people to say, well, this is a public hospital, it's been paid out of taxpayers' money. Why is he using it for his business? Why is he being allowed to use this infrastructure without an apparent cost? He's using this because he has the office he uses for his public patients, he uses to consult with his private patients, so he's not bearing a cost for it. How is he being allowed to use double job, as it were, on the back of the state? And that, I think, is a reasonable question. It's a fair enough question.
I mean, yes, it is a fair question, and there is an argument to be made that there should be a clear split between public and private hospitals. The problem is we built this system.
Yeah.
So you have a situation in which consultants have contracts which allow them to do these things. So if you remove the ability to do this from consultants...
Yes, what happens?
And there's certain people saying that not only should this be removed from public hospitals, but the public hospitals should have the right to decide if consultants can take up this kind of work outside of that hospital.
Yeah.
Even if it is in a private hospital, which is to say consultants may just have this entire line of work cut off from them. You now need to go and renegotiate all those contracts, and it will be a mammoth undertaking that may slow down consultant recruitment because it's a loss of money to them. But as to the actual advantages of doing this, the practical advantages of doing this for patients.
Yes.
Well, the report, the de Boutelaire report, is actually pretty honest about this. It basically says that we can't predict what the results are going to be, but if there is any increase in capacity for public patients in the hospitals after we do this, it's likely to be rather small.
Okay, so we're not looking at a significant increase in capacity. Now, going back to the consultants, there would have to be a renegotiation of the contracts that we have at the moment. Now, quite a few people, percentage-wise in Ireland, carry private health insurance of some kind.
Do you have private health insurance?
No, God, no, I'm far too poor, but the rest of my family do. I have to say, get rather annoyed that I seem to receive pretty well the same level of care that they do when we go to hospital.
But wasn't there was a thing recently where people with private insurance were going to public hospitals and were being treated as public patients because they weren't making use of their insurance at all. And then the public hospitals were charging their insurer.
Yes.
Even though they had received... They hadn't gone in as private patients and they hadn't received any advantage for being private patients.
It is worth pointing out, I suppose, in passing, that all of these private patients, it's not as if they've been allowed to opt out of the tax system which we use to subvent public health in the country. They're paying their dues as well. And the fact is that from what I know about the demographic shape of the people who pay for private health insurance, those people with the most private health insurance are also people who are at the upper end of the tax pyramid and are paying their own fair lashing of tax. So it's not as if they're freeloaders. Worth pointing that out. But sorry, on the issue of the consultants, we know we have a problem with the number of consultants. We are under-consulted in this country, as it were, and we have consistent problems with recruiting and retaining consultants in this country. Now, there are money issues, there are time issues, there are also structural training issues there, I am given to understand. Is it possible that in a situation where these things were renegotiated, that some consultants would simply say, okay, I'm just going to go private?
I would say that is the most likely outcome in this. So a lot of work. So there are certain operations, particularly certain elective operations, in which over 50% of all that are done in the state are currently in the private sector. So things on hips, knees, Someone once told me elective heart surgeries, but I don't know what an elective heart surgery is, so I don't know if that's correct.
Somebody just wants a prettier heart. Not a better one, but just a slightly more attractive.
Draw a face on it. Yeah. Like a smiley face.
Smiley face heart, yeah.
So you will have, if this goes through, you will have a couple of things will happen immediately. Your taxes are going to go up.
Right.
Probably quite substantially, frankly. Mm-hmm. Because here's the thing. If you... That 650 million is money that is given from private healthcare system into the public healthcare system for the use of facilities.
Mm.
If it doesn't go to the public healthcare system, it's still there. So the private healthcare system are going to use it themselves. And they're probably going to skill up or to increase access or to build another hospital. So it's going to make private healthcare look better.
Mm.
Because it will be better because it's already... better.
Mm-hmm.
So you will have to invest massively into the public healthcare system in order to counteract that.
You remember these things better than I do. Just on the issue of cost, do you remember a cost report that came out a little while ago, which compared the cost of doing certain kinds of procedures in private hospitals, opposed to being charged for the same from public hospitals. And in a number of the cases, the private hospitals came out as rather more efficient.
I believe on average, private hospitals are able to provide better standards of care for less money, sometimes substantially less money than the public hospitals.
Quite a bit of money.
Now, what the public hospitals tend to say to that is that there is a selection bias in that private hospitals don't deal with the most serious cases. It's mostly elective cases.
Yeah.
But even from what I remember of a like-for-like analysis, private hospitals were miles ahead because, well, private hospitals don't, just as a random example, go continuously over budget for 4 years straight.
Yeah, because you can't. Because you can't just turn around and say, can we get another 850 million, please, because we need it. Because...
Please, government.
Yeah.
Please.
At the bottom of this, is this not based not so much on a pragmatic approach to the best provision of services, but rather a moral intuition that somehow it's wrong that a rich man should be able to afford better quality healthcare than a poor child? That if a child has some kind of blood disorder, terrible thing, which if he had the money, if the parents had the money, they may be able to bring him somewhere or do something with him. But they're relying on the public health system, and the public health doesn't have that capacity. And that's somehow wrong. It's immoral.
That's pretty much what this is. This is a moral or ideological standpoint that basically this is wrong to allow, and so therefore we've got to stop it. Even if stopping it will probably make the healthcare system worse. Now, I've had the chance to sit down with Donal, not about this report, but a year or so previous, just about the HSE in general. And I'm not sure where he actually stands on this issue. But from what I remember, this was put forward in the Sláintecare report. So I would assume he was told, well, we said we'd do this, find out how we'd implement it.
Mm.
And this is how you'd implement it, by basically taking a chunk of money out of the health service and then having to replace it with taxes.
Yeah, I did not notice that the number of new taxes that are building up under this government are starting to get fairly serious. Increased, depending on what kind of car you drive, they are really going after people, which, let's face it, we're talking about the kind of cars that are being punished are being driven by people who don't have the money to buy new cars or to buy the less tax cars. So the higher tax on cars. Also, they're going to go soon after diesel. Diesel is going to go up, and that again is going to take diesel. Historically, was people who worked and drove a lot but couldn't afford the luxury of a petrol car. We have the 8% compulsory pension, which is coming in 2021, isn't it? Supposedly. Is there going to be any... Are we going to have any money left?
I mean, we already have a marginal rate of between 49.5 and 35,000.
Yeah.
Which is the lowest. I mean, to pay a rate like that in France, you'd be on 200,000.
Yes.
Or above.
High tax France.
Yeah. And then we're like, oh, we'll add an 8% on that and we'll add some more for the hospital. And I've loved seeing the sort of, well, maybe your taxes need to go up. And you sort of go, to where?
Yeah.
Like, what do you want from me?
Yeah. I think they're going to get to a point pretty soon where we're like, for the first time, we're going to see people leaving the country, not specifically because of the old fashioned, there are no jobs or we left Ireland and mother because we were poor, but people going, you know what? I'm working and working and working. We're back to the good old days of Gareth Fitzgerald.
Sure, let's say you're currently at 49.5%. Let's say you earn 50,000.
Yeah.
So you're into the marginal rate, and the government then goes, we're going to add that 8% pension levy to you.
Yeah.
You could be paying 60% of your marginal rate could be 60%.
Also, I keep seeing this and hearing this 8% bandied around. And they're talking about it as if, well, you know, it could be 8%. 8%! An overnight increase in direct taxation on your global income of 8%, and a decline, therefore, of 8% in your income, that's massive. I mean, really, that's a huge chunk of money. For people who don't have discretionary income and don't have any fat, because they'll be trying to pay down the debt, but the debt is still there for a lot of people. It reduced a lot, but still some there. I don't know where they think this money is going to come from.
No, it sort of reminds me of the RTE license fee increase, a lot of these tax options, where you're just like, we've done literally nothing to see if we can save money, so we're going to have to charge more. And this is sort of, well, maybe, lads, and this might be totally out of the blue, you could try and get some control on the spending before asking me to pay thousands more a year to you. Maybe we could do that.
We are a horribly biddable, quiet people. This notion that people once had of us, and we maybe had of ourselves, as being these kind of wild, anarchic people, to me was definitively put to bed with the smoking ban. Not that I was against the smoking ban, even though I was a smoker, but rather people had said, oh, it'll be this, it'll be that, it'll be eruptions. I was in the pub the night it went in because I was working there. The ashtrays were picked up at midnight, and I'd never heard not a word, a jot or a tittle of reaction. In fact, going around the country today, you can see people dutifully standing and breaking the law by drinking after hours, but standing outside when they have their fag. We don't have our gilets jaunes. We are not people who get out and protest in large numbers. The water protest was effectively, and that was well organised and properly organised by a bunch of good old-fashioned Leninists who know how to get a bunch of people going. And I do think that we may be heading towards another version of the water protest, but maybe a deeper and darker experience.
I mean, I am unusual in my social economic grouping in that I don't have private healthcare. And I would say I'd say nearly everyone I know has private healthcare. And I would say this, for all that these people are lovely and progressive and warm, you will take their private healthcare from their dead hands.
The one thing I in conversations I've had, talking to friends of mine, particularly now at my age, we're talking about people with children and children going on, they again and again they would say the one thing, the last thing to go when they're cutting, the last thing to go will be the VHI. That's, there is, they desperately hold it. Now, I'm kind of curious to know if somebody has done the work on this. Do you really, in a system like Ireland, do you actually really get the benefit from paying for it? Whether you do or you don't, there is a deep-seated perception that if at all, you can afford to get private healthcare, you really, really, really want to do it.
There's a thing you see with the Americans and guns, where they will have come and take it written on the side of guns.
Yeah.
Comes from, or sometimes Mullen Lab, which is the, it was the famous Spartan quote about, I think it was one of the Persian kings threatened their weapons and the response was just come and take them. And I kind of get that sense with private insurance. You'll have little private insurance car with Molon Lab written across them. And the people who benefit from this are never going to vote for the government anyway.
No, no, no.
But the people who they take private healthcare insurance. Now, I would say, to be fair, if I worked in private healthcare, this thing is fantastic. Because you look at it and you go, okay, they'll have to come to private hospitals. The public health service will have to skill up massively to fill this hole.
Mm.
They'll screw it up spectacularly because it's the HSE. And we're going to get a great deal more patients. In fact, the private hospital industry group has already come out and said, basically, fantastic plan. Give us a date.
And that's something that should give everybody pause for thought.
No, I mean, here's the thing. If Sláintecare leads to the removal of 650 million, consultants are then far more likely to go into the private lane. That will decrease the capability of public hospitals to deal with healthcare issues. It will make them worse.
Yeah.
So the private system knows this. And they're like, okay, do this. We'll get more people. We can lower wages for consultants because we'll have more of them coming on. We're going to get ones who don't really want to come into the private healthcare, but we'll do it because of what you're doing to them. And you're going to bollocks this up spectacularly, which is going to mean that people actually need more private healthcare.
Yeah, and more money will be poured into this vast gaping hole.
And that's, I have seen a couple of the members of the consultants trade group basically saying this could work, but for it to work these things will happen, and the worst thing that can happen for public healthcare is partial implementation of this plan because the pain comes first.
If this is part of Sláintecare, let's put it on the back burner, because I cannot believe that anybody seriously is going to attempt to implement Sláintecare, because that wouldn't be just the death of the health system in Ireland, that would be the death of people in Ireland. It is going to be so extravagantly expensive and won't work, by the way. I can't believe that they're actually going to attempt to implement it. The numbers are too eye-watering.
No, it's... But they don't know what else to do, because this is a government that doesn't have any ideas.
Well, I don't know, Gary, but I've heard tell of a thing called the market. Free market? Do you ever hear of it? And I'm told it's very good.
No, I mean, we've just had a report that basically said, blow your back of your own brains out because we can't have people getting unequal healthcare access. So I think we're a bit away from market solutions to the problem.
Which means we're a bit away from solutions to the problem. And
speaking of being pretty far away from solutions to the problem.
Yes.
Housing.
Oh.
New housing development in Coolock.
Yeah, it's a beauty. No, listen, I would say...
A monolithic... Yeah. Skyscraper of all 10 stories of it.
Well, 8 to 9, because the original 10 was knocked back, I think, by Lord Planola. Because obviously 10 stories, my God.
Michael, do you ever think that if we... you ever think if we got... If we just lined up every member of On Board Planola and shot them?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously that would be a terrible crime and they have families and that would be terrible. But do you not think the country would be better off afterwards?
Well, you see, Gary, I'm a bit old-fashioned in this. I'd like to think that the first
thing you do... We can guillotine them.
Yeah. I think the first thing you do is you take out and you kill everybody in Antashka. Then you do all your Planola.
You know, that's true. Get Antashka and use that to send a message.
Yeah. And it's a very beautiful message that anybody who lives in, say, a Queen Anne rectory doesn't get to have an opinion about somebody building a bungalow two miles away. But the issue here, well, first of all, is, yes, as you quote the report, these are monolithic and would set an undesirable precedent. The thing about, they're 8-9 stories high. That's, frankly, not monolithic. We're a long way from the pyramids of Giza here. They may be attractive, they may be unattractive, I don't know. A lot of that will depend on how well they're maintained, on their finish, on how they're landscaped, that kind of thing. But if you go to any bloody city in Europe or around the world, and you go to the burbs, you go and they have flats. They live in flats. And that's the cheapest way that you can live in a decent space. And most of my friends that lived on the edge of Milan or the edge of Rome lived in flats, and the flats tended to be 15 to 20 stories high. This is not monolithic. If we're either going to build houses in the country or we're not. Now, if we want to build semis with gardens, let's just accept the fact that Dublin is going to reach Mullingar fairly in the next 10 years. And there will be nothing but houses between Dublin and Gorey and Dublin and Drogheda or Dundalk. But if you don't want that, we're going to have to build up a little bit. But the, for example, one of the problems, now I don't like the fact, full stop, that people object on, you know, Lord Pranola can object on aesthetic grounds.
I quite love it because it's a sort of, we have a crippling homelessness crisis. Prices in Dublin for houses have stopped rising purely because we've reached a point where people literally cannot pay anything else.
The dirt of the body first, yeah.
And we desperately need more housing. And then it goes to On Lord Pranola and they go, well, yes, all of those are considerations, but it is fiercely ugly. And is it not better that you starve on the street than live in an ugly building, which is an admirable commitment to the principles of aesthetic refinement, Michael. And I think they should be lauded for it. Yes, they've probably killed a couple of children due to cold, but fuck it. We've got pretty buildings.
Yeah, except, Gary, if only we did have pretty buildings. There's a game I like to play. When I was staying in Dublin for work, I used to stay in the Montclair Hotel, which is on Merrion Square. And we were very reasonably priced because it was 3-star. And it was right in the centre of town. Anyway, you could look out the window of the Montclair, and you're looking out to Merrion Square, and you saw there's the Davenport Hotel, and there was the American College, and then you had this the terrace at the bottom there, heading towards the back of Trinity or whatever. It's not Harcourt Street. Anyway, if you look around, all you could see were Georgian houses, Victorian houses, Georgian Square, Merrion Square, one of the finest Georgian squares in Dublin, and therefore one of the finest Georgian squares in the world. There was one building there, only one, as far as I could see, that would have gone through the full, proper, modern system of planning and approval by planning boards and architects and engineers and Dublin Corporation and all of its functionaries. And it's absolutely hideous. And it's a print and paper company, which I won't name because obviously that wouldn't be raised, but whose exterior is covered in what I call public toilet tile exterior.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know it when you see it.
You know it when you see it. If we were getting from these people these wonderful, beautiful buildings, maybe. But remember, these are the people who gave planning permission for the ESB on the longest Georgian terrace in the world. And we got ESB pillboxes, concrete pillboxes. I know for a fact that there around the country, there are houses refused because certain planners don't like brick. And if you get that guy, you won't get your planning. If you get the other person who doesn't mind brick, you get planning. That's nonsense. But. Do you know Coolock at all, Gary?
I actually grew up in Coolock.
So that's interesting. You can tell me then that the proposed form would be unsympathetic relative to the character of the local area. What is the character of the local? Victorian, Georgian, Art Nouveau, is it?
I would say modern with a light dusting of meth.
Okay, so not so much Art Deco.
Well, no, probably when I was there it was more heroin, but no, it was fine. It was an inner city suburb area. There are some greens. It's not a terribly pretty place.
You don't feel that the aesthetic would be fundamentally undermined by the building of 8-9-story apartment blocks?
Well, I mean, this is an area that previously had some very tall, solid grey social housing apartment blocks, or the flats, more accurately. So, no, I don't think it's out of the character of the region. In fact, in many ways, it's a callback to its rich heritage drug dealing and nighttime stabbings.
It's rich architectural heritage. There's a line here which I just love. This is the principal planner who had originally actually refused permission. And this is quoted in The Independent. She said, "The subsequent influx of tenants to the area will, quote, give rise to an increase in population, within this local area. Now, can you imagine that, Gary? Building flats will cause people to come and live in the area, which would cause an increase in population. You see, I would never have thought of that.
And then, Michael, there's too little employment in the direct area. But I mean, if only there were some means of transport that could take one from, let's say, Coolock to Dublin city centre.
Yeah, or if only Coolock was near a large centre of population where there might be economic activity. But it, unfortunately, being as it is, located between Malin Head and Killybegs, it is isolated. And
however, I will say, I mean, this story does have a silver lining in that this report came out. It's from On Board Planala, which is, of course, very important in the planning process. And then it looks like the local council went, well, that's all super, but we're going to build it anyway.
Well, that was the attitude of On Board Planala. I want to quote, again, assuming the Independent is quoting these people accurately, to local politicians, just for an insight into why we have no houses in the country in the first place. Sinn Féin's Larry O'Toole said local people were furious about the visual impact the development would have in the area. The visual impact this is going to have on Coolock has the people furious, and therefore, of course, they shouldn't be built there. And then we have a quote from a local, his colleague on the council, Patricia Rowe, the Social Democrats. I'm all for high density, but we seem to be going the wrong way about it because of the housing crisis. Which says, translated, that says, I have to say that I'm all for housing density because everybody now knows that we have thousands of people without a home in Dublin. So I have to say this. But obviously I don't want them built anywhere near me.
No, and this has been, the great joy. I will note that everyone that you talk about speaking out against this is left-wing.
Yes.
And it's one of those weird things I've really enjoyed. Left-wing parties in the National Parliament chastising the government for not doing anything about the housing crisis, where when you look at the council level, where most of this, the actual attempts to build stuff is dying.
Yeah.
The left-wing parties have just been guillotining stuff left and right.
Gary, I can tell you that this historically has been going on forever because lots of reasons. One reason is, the left is horrified by the notion that developers and builders will make money out of this. Genuinely, they hate it. I remember a prominent member of the Labour Party once on television saying, and I think it's outrageous that these people are profiting for the needs that people have, the rights that people have to have a home. And they're profiting from it. So they don't like that. And the reason they don't like, they're going to object to anything which is private because they want to see all housing of this kind to be public and to be funded and owned by the state.
Actually, there's news that's just after coming out while we've been recording this. So I think we might replace the last item on the list with this,
okay,
actually.
Go ahead.
Boris Johnson, the government has confirmed they are going to ask the Queen to suspend Parliament.
Oh, Boris Johnson is going to ask the Queen to suspend, to prorogue Parliament, that would be.
Which means that the British Parliament will not be able to, in any way, stop Brexit.
No. Well, we shall see how this story unfolds. In order to avoid him doing this, there had been a bill went through Parliament regarding the administration of government in the north of Ireland, and particularly issues regarding Stormont not sitting. And in order to avoid this, some of the Remainers, I'm not sure, maybe the Labour Party, attached an amendment requiring the House to sit over the period of the 31st of October, meaning that they couldn't not be there in order. And as you know, there is also a bill was passed which said that the British cannot have a no deal Brexit. So I wonder, he's taken legal advice of some kind, he knows.
Well, if the government isn't sitting, technically he can't be told to do anything, and unless he himself specifically asks for an extension, it can't be given. So what it looks like is happening is, so the British Parliament is not sitting at the minute. When it sits, then they're going to ask the Queen to prorogue Parliament.
Yeah.
And then they will just pretty much be impossible to stop them going out with no deal. So it looks like they're aiming to get Parliament suspended on the 10th of September, which gives them basically a couple of days to make any changes they need to do. Now, this may just be, the fact it's leaked may in fact just be an attempt by Boris Johnson to force people to bring them down.
Uh-huh.
Because they want an election, and with the Fixed Term Act of the British Parliament, the government can't simply call for the election. However, if Parliament thinks it's going to be prorogued, they may just bring down Johnson himself, and then Johnson will have his election and he'll win.
Well, at the moment, all of the polls, certainly one thing has happened, and that's the Tories have had a massive turnaround in the polling.
Massive, absolutely massive. They're up to about 33%, which, considering how everyone else is polling, would be a majority of quite substantial size.
Yeah, yeah. They would. The Brexit party threat seems to, as regards taking seats, has receded, but may be successful enough in certain areas.
Yeah,
to split the Labour vote rather badly and give the Tories seats where they never had a seat before.
Yeah, I think that would be their big concern, that the Brexit Party will manage to throw them off. Now, if they can manage to get a deal with the Brexit Party, where the Brexit Party will not run in all areas, but will instead run in traditionally Labour areas,
yeah,
that could be devastating to Labour.
Oh yeah, and you could see some really weird results happening all over the gaff with that. Well, this is something to follow. We shall see how it evolves over the next day, and we should, I imagine, come back to it when it has evolved on Sunday. We'll be in a better position to talk about it.
Yeah, so if you're interested in that story, the BBC put it up roughly 60 seconds ago. So enjoy that. And this is going up quite soon, so by the time you hear this, it may not have actually hit much major news sites yet.
Very good. But anyway, until Sunday, when we have a little more clarity, I suppose it's time to say bye-bye.
All the best.